Some of our listeners might have heard your story or listened to you on Dave Rubin's show, but I would love to start off by just telling your story. What happened?
Okay. A lot has happened, but I will try to condense it as much as possible. So I was born and raised in Canada, and my mother was the second wife to a Egyptian man. So my, in Islam, men can marry up to four wives concurrently. And so this man had two wives, and my mom was his second wife. So the first one is his legal one. She was a convert, a Canadian convert to Islam. And the second one was my mom, who was not legally his wife, but Islamically she was his wife. And before my mom married him, we had a pretty secular, normal upbringing. So even though my mom was born and raised Muslim as well, she wasn't really practicing. Her family wasn't really practicing. And she didn't really raise us with that much of an Islamic environment. But once she married this man, everything changed. And she all of a sudden started to wear hijab, which means to cover her hair. And demands were made on us, like we had to start reading the Quran and praying five times a day and no longer allowed to have non-Muslim friends, which was the worst part for me, and no longer allowed to ride a bicycle because I'm a girl, no longer allowed to go swimming because I can't show so much skin. And just everything was haram, 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 forbidden, forbidden, forbidden. Music is forbidden. He'd break our records. Like, you know, my life completely changed when he entered our life. And then when I was about 9 years old, hijab was put on me and I was sent to an Islamic school in the local mosque. So I was very immersed in that Islamic community. My mother was the head of the Islamic studies department at that school. So she was like a pillar of the community. And so we all had to be like the perfect Muslim children. And then once I graduated from high school, I was forced into a marriage with a man that my family thought was strong enough to control me because I was always questioning and I was never quite the dutiful Muslim daughter that they wanted me to be. So they decided that they'd marry me off to somebody who would control me. And so they married me off to a man named Assam Marzouk, who is an Egyptian member of Al-Qaeda, who is currently in prison for his terrorism, which includes his involvement in the bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa. And when I was married to him, we had a daughter together. And something about having a daughter and looking at her and realizing she's going to have the same life that I lived gave me the strength, gave me the courage to fight back finally. So the courage I didn't have to fight back for myself, I had to fight for her. And I was able to, through a long series of events, which are detailed in my book, which is called Unveiled, you can read in more detail, but essentially I was able to get away from him and escape with my daughter. And then I started going to university, which was something that was not allowed. I wasn't allowed to go to university when I was with my mother. But once I got away from him and I got away from my mom, then I started going to university. And when I was in university, I took a course called History of Religions. And that was the course that allowed me to finally look at Islam from a critical lens. You know, I could actually question it. I could actually think about it. I could actually compare it to other religions. And this, the kind of you know, critical thinking and critical analysis that was not allowed when I was growing up, that whenever I asked these questions, I was told, that's the devil whispering in your ear. That's the devil making you doubt. Now in this classroom, I was finally able to question and think and poke and prod. And so, of course, once you're able to do that, it doesn't take long before you realize that this whole religion is, you know, just a bunch of silly and dangerous fairy tales. And I was very quiet about leaving Islam because, of course, the punishment for leaving Islam is execution. You don't have to be, you know, obviously there are 15 different countries that will execute you, but even if you're in a country where it's not state mandated, like it's not state sanctioned execution, you should still, you know, your other Muslim community members take it upon themselves as their responsibility to kill you for leaving. So I was threatened with threatened with death from my mother. So I stayed away from her, and my daughter and I moved away, and we changed our names, and we just lived our lives quietly, didn't have any connection to my family or my community or to any friends that I had before, because I was really afraid of my Al-Qaeda ex just finding us. Mm. So I wanted to make sure that we had no, you know, there were no breadcrumbs for him to follow that would lead him to us. And I lived like that for, you know, a long time. Just, you know, that's just going through my own stuff privately until I saw the episode of Bill Maher with Sam Harris and Ben Affleck, which is the same episode that got Dave Rubin to completely change his way that he was living before too.
So just to recap that episode for our listeners, what happened?
So in that episode, Bill Maher and Sam Harris were talking about how liberals are very supportive of liberal ideas up until you mention that those liberal ideas are not found in the Islamic world. And then all of a sudden they don't want to talk about it anymore. So they're all like, LGBTQ rights, yay, you know, pride parade, rainbow flag. And then you say, did you know that in 15 Muslim majority countries, gay people are executed by the state? Then they don't want to talk anymore. Then that's Islamophobic, that's racist, that's bigoted. So, you know, gay people that are from Muslim communities, we don't want to talk about them. We don't care about defending their rights or bringing awareness to their struggles. So that was just one of the examples, but they specifically brought up that in Egypt, which is where my mother's family is from, 86% of people in Egypt believe that people who leave Islam, like me, should be killed. And so that's a very personal statistic for them to bring up. And I felt so seen. I felt so heard. I felt so grateful that these two men were on just, you know, national television, on just mainstream media, talking about this problem, which was very real to me. And as I'm feeling this excitement and happiness that they're finally addressing this issue, Ben Affleck comes swooping in and he's like, you guys are gross. You're racist. You got to stop talking like this. You're talking about Muslims like the way you would say a shifty Jew, and pretending that what these men are talking about was not about the religion itself and how it oppresses the people under it. But he started to act as if these men were being racist or bigoted towards Muslim people, which was not at all what they were doing. And Sam very clearly made a distinction between criticizing the ideas versus being bigoted towards the human beings. Yeah. And it's so ironic that Ben Affleck had this meltdown, considering he starred in a movie called Dogma, which was all about criticizing the religion of Christianity. And so he understands that you can criticize dogma, you can criticize religion without being a Christianophobe or whatever. Like nobody is would ever accuse him of being bigoted or you know, prejudiced or racist towards Christian people. Everybody understands that he's criticizing the dogma. But when it comes to Islam, all of a sudden people's brains just misfire and everything just goes haywire and they can't just follow the same thread of logic. I don't understand what happens when Islam comes up, but it definitely gets treated differently than any other ideology or any other religion.
So this is where it gets really interesting, because I agree with you that there's something about this topic which is sensitive and it's triggering people and it's keeping us from being using logic or being rational. And I've watched this clip several times. I've almost studied the clip in a kind of a David Attenborough way, you know, studying the species of, you know, what is going on right here. I've tried to understand, and I've tried to understand through different perspectives. I mean, I even tried to think about, as a thought experiment, what if Ben Affleck was my brother or my friend, and he acted that way? And I really wanted to understand him and really get to the core of why he was acting that way, and not pinning him out to be this, you know, reactive, stupid lefty or liberal. But really trying to understand him, because this is symptomatic not only to this situation but to a lot of different conversations I had with people, you know. And other conversations I listened to and observed. So there's something here to understand, because he's not actually listening to what Bill Maher and Sam Harris are saying. You can actually hear him mirroring their words, and it's not their words. Mm-hmm. He's misinterpreting them and he's not listening to what they're saying, but it's like he's listening to this effectual and triggered voice in his head, and he's upset. And I'm wondering, what is it? What kind of scenario is he painting up in his head? What is that voice telling him? Because he's actually upset. He's not making that up. He's actually upset, and I'm really wondering why. He thinks these guys are racists. And I wanted just to talk to you about if you were to interpret Ben Affleck in an empathic and kind way, what do you think actually went on in his brain?
So here's the thing, Navid. I have no more patience. I have lost the ability to say, but it comes from a good place. I'm tired of saying that. I can't. The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Right.
I'm over it. I don't care if it comes from good intentions or not. Because even though it's coming from good intentions, it was still incredibly stupid. It was still incredibly dangerous. And he still provided cover for oppressors instead of protecting and defending victims. So yes, I understand that he did that because in his own mind, in his own whatever internal dialogue was going on in there that had nothing to do with what was happening in the real world, had nothing to do with what Sam had said or what Bill had said, it was just in his own head, he felt that he was defending these Muslim people from these horrible racist men. That's what he thought he was doing. Mm. But to be perfectly honest, I don't think he cares about Muslim people. I think he only cares about looking like he cares about Muslim people. Because if he cared about Muslim people, he would be concerned about the statistics that those men were citing. You know, he would be concerned about women that are thrown in prison because they don't want to wear hijab. He would be concerned about children who are being forced into marriages when they are still children. He would be concerned about FGM. He would be concerned about gay people being killed if they come from Muslim families. You know what I mean? Like, if you actually cared about those people, then you would be caring about the victims. You wouldn't be caring about the ideology and the fundamentalist people from that ideology. You wouldn't be caring to defend the religion of Islam. You would be caring to defend the Muslims that are being oppressed by Islam and the non-Muslims that are being oppressed by Islam as well. But he's not caring about the humans. He's caring about the ideology. And that is the distinct difference between him and Bill and Sam sitting at that table. That was the difference.
Right. So there's what I'm thinking that it is that there's also the layer of Islamophobia to it. Like, that's an actual existing problem, but these two layers often get mixed up.
Yes, of course. Like,
yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, yes, of course, that's a problem, okay? Yeah. But when we are comparing which one of these issues is a bigger problem or which one of these issues is being swept under the rug, we hear about Islamophobia left, right, and center. Everybody thinks that it happens on a daily basis to every hijabi woman out there. And it's actually not nearly as much of a big deal as we make it out to be. But we're always talking about it. So it has been addressed. Okay. What has not been addressed is the opposite side of that, is how we're not talking about how Muslims are treated in non-Muslim countries, because that has been addressed. But let's talk about how non-Muslims are treated in Muslim countries, for example. Nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to talk about all the Christians that are being killed or how ex-Muslims have to live in you know, being ostracized by their families and by their communities. Like, we have to have like the conversation needs to be fair and it needs to be nuanced. And when nobody wants to talk about anything that happens because it's happening from the fundamentalist Muslim community, then you end up with problems like that you have in Sweden with your anti-Semitism rising through the roof. And that's happening because nobody wants to address anti-Semitism if it's coming from the Muslim community. So we're just going to keep on sweeping it under the rug and staying quiet about it. Worse things happen when you sweep it under the rug and you stay quiet about it. Girls get raped in rape gangs in the UK by the thousands, girls as young as 11. Like, all sorts of horrific things happen when you refuse to address an issue, when you refuse to talk about an issue. And I think
why do you think that is? Why do you think that it's harder to address that issue?
I think a lot of it has to do with fear, because they see like Charlie Hebdo and they see the trucks of peace and so they feel like if we criticize Islam, then they're going to attack us. So there's two issues there. So first of all, if you could just look at the bravery of people in countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh and Iran and Iraq and all over countries where you can, Saudi Arabia, where people are they are lashed in the streets, they are hung by cranes, they are beheaded, they are shot in the head, they are imprisoned for speaking out against Islam.
Right.
And when we're here in the free world, where, you know, in America, where the very First Amendment includes free speech, people aren't forced to keep their mouths shut, but they are forcing themselves to keep their own mouths shut. It's a self-imposed blasphemy law. And what we have here are jihadis and Islamists both wanting to do the work of, number one, spreading Islam, and number two, stopping the criticism against Islam. But they're doing it in two different ways, of course. You have the jihadis that are going around just stabbing people on different bridges in London or whatever. And so that scares people physically from speaking up against Muslims. And then you have Islamists who are people who are in nice suits, you know, and trimmed beards, and they don't use violence, but they will create terms like the term Islamophobia, which also forces people into silence. So both groups are achieving that same goal of silencing the criticism against their religion, but they're using two different methods. One method works really well in the Muslim world, and the other method works really well in the non-Muslim world.
I mean, my grandmother is Muslim. A lot of my relatives in Iran are Muslims, and they're afraid as well, right? They are also. I remember when I was visiting and I was talking to my younger cousins, especially the girls, and I think we were about 12 years old, and they were wearing their hijabs, and it's not like the people are fine with that. I mean, there's a lot of conversations going on and a lot of skepticism and a lot of questioning, and so talking about like the whole concept of the hijab, like the hijab being a symbol of empowerment and being a symbol of feminism, it's mainly a concept I've heard of in the West.
Mm-hmm.
No one I know who lives in a Muslim country wearing a hijab, being a woman or a girl, wants to do that.
Absolutely. 100%. And this is why I always say, if you just allow people the freedom to think, if you separate mosque and state, can you imagine just the art and the literature and the music and the humanity that will come out of Iran the Islamic regime just removes this, you know, this tyranny that they have holding the people down? I mean, it's just going to be a tsunami. The world is just, it can just sit back and just appreciate all of the beauty that's going to come out of that country, you know? And that's just one. That's just one country out of all of these, like almost 60 Muslim majority countries, where people are just being held under this tyranny. And we don't get to see what they offer the world. It is it's really sad when you think of it from that perspective. But yes, you make an incredibly important point. Muslim people are the very first victims of Islam. They're the very, you know, as soon as they're brainwashed from birth into this ideology and they're forced not to question it and they're forced not to speak out about it, they are shackled, men and women, you know, obviously women to a greater degree.
I mean, the hijab is also, from a personal point of view, as a man, I think it's of course, it's a very, I couldn't even imagine being a woman being forced to wear a niqab or hijab, but the hijab is also to prevent women from the stare of or the gaze of men, as if we were just these animals, exactly, not being able to control ourselves. So it's also like a spit in the face of insulting to men as well. But so just as a thought experiment, in a liberal society, in a modern society, or a liberal secular society, if you wish to be Muslim, if you wish to wear a hijab of your own choice, I mean, please do.
Absolutely.
If you want to be Amish, if you want to be Hindu, yep, if you want to be Muslim, wear a niqab or a hijab. I mean, I don't have a problem, because living in a liberal society means the liberty of all. I mean, you go be a Scientologist. I don't care, but it's there's a real important line where you enforce these rules on your kids,
yes,
or on other people, and that's where I think we need to talk about. So this is where we need to talk about liberalism as well.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. And even, you know, what you said about, like, you want to be a Scientologist, you want to be whatever you want, that's completely your business. But you're never going to see Xenu on the cover of a magazine, right? we're not going to celebrate it and say, oh, this is, you know, some fantastic religious practice that we want to have, you know, on the cover of Sports Illustrated. So that's where the line, I think, that we cross in the Western world is,
well, there's a lot of repercussions for people who stop being Scientologists as well. I mean, that's,
oh yes,
yeah,
no doubt, 100%. In fact, I relate so much to ex-Scientologists myself, and ex-Jehovah's Witness and ex-Mormons. You know, we have very similar experiences, just having grown up in a very tight-knit community.
Yeah, so a few days ago, I was talking to another guest on the podcast, Emma Gingrich, who's an ex-Amish.
Mm-hmm.
And she ran away from the Amish community when she was 17. And I was asking her about all these. I mean, I was like, so why didn't you just go on your Rumspringer, like your this year of doing anything you choose? And she was telling me that's a myth. That's not even a real thing in all Amish societies, in all Amish communities. So the community she was a part of didn't have Rumspringer. That was just, you know, that's out of the question. I mean, allowing your kids to go out for a year to do whatever they want, that's a big no. And so she was telling me about this really, all these weird rituals and principles, and how she thought that the earth was flat. She didn't even know who was the president. It was a cult. It is a cult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's similarities between what she talks about and what you talk about, and there's the aspect of looking in to those communities from the outside as a liberal, but it's a whole other issue being a part of a community or a group and telling your story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking stories that come out of those communities. Like when you were talking, I was remembering a friend of mine that was brought up in a Hasidic Jewish community in New York, but he never learned to speak English.
Yeah.
He was 18 years old when he first started to speak English, so it's pretty crazy. But, you know, when he speaks out, you know, he's in a documentary that's on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen it.
Ari Horshowitz.
Yeah.
So, you know, people, the world is happy to empathize with people that have left the Church of Scientology. You know, Leah Remini has a show on A&E, a documentary where she speaks to people who have left Scientology. The world is okay, and not just okay, but embracing of people that have left all sorts of different fundamentalist ideologies. But when you have left Islam, again, like I was saying at the beginning of this interview, when you leave Islam, you get treated differently. You don't get embraced in the same way.
And just to be fair, I mean, the people treating you badly on the Muslim side are still radicals, right? Still, I mean, the majority of Muslims, do they even care if you're a Muslim or not?
I don't even have a problem if Muslims hate me, because that makes sense to me. I understand them being, you know, feeling offended that I am criticizing their religion, or feeling offended that I am, you know, whistleblowing about the culture of people living under Islam. What I don't understand are liberal, left-leaning, free-thinking, open-minded Western people having a problem with me speaking out against Islam. Those are the people that I should be embraced by, should be supported by, but instead those are the people that are either at best ignoring me or at worst calling me a racist bigot.
Yeah. So just to be fair, like some of the liberals are not all.
Of course. No. Just,
there's a lot of people like myself and Sam and Dave and a lot of people actually believing in liberalism and seeing that you've been treated unfairly.
Let's just assume that everything, when we speak in generalizations, that there's always a hashtag, not all.
It's important to me to point out because there's hope in that as well. Like there are people actually believing in liberalism for all.
And
also supporting you in your sharing your story and being part of this conversation. But I'm still curious. I'm radically curious about what you said. Fear. I mean, fear of repercussion, fear of terrorism, fear of violence. I'm curious to see what liberals need to work on. I mean, there's the idea of liberalism is a beautiful idea, but in practice, wow, it's a hard manifestation of a really radical idea. I mean, freedom for all, that demands something for you. You need to put a lot of effort and courage in that practice.
You need to assume the best in humanity and you need to make sure that people are educated.
Yeah.
But I think
that's the basis of it.
That's the basis of it, yeah. I think that what they need to do is stay consistent with their values. So let's just take this Iran uprising revolution that's happening right now as the example. So right now, if they were to stay consistent with their values, they would look at these people in Iran that are literally risking their lives. I mean, 1,500 people as a rough estimate were murdered by this Islamic regime, protesters, just murdered in cold blood and left their bodies just like left in the, you know, rivers and lakes and just on the streets. So we know that this is an incredibly tyrannical dictatorship. Naturally, if you were to stay consistent with your liberal values, you would 100% support the protesters on the streets right now, the same way we're supporting the protesters in Hong Kong. Mm. But instead, what you see are people putting their own politics and basically, you know, narcissism of their own navel gazing ahead of their values. So they don't like Trump. And if supporting the Iranian people looks like it might be supporting Trump, then they won't do it. They will be against the protesters and support the regime so that their own political, you know, what they want to, what side they want to be on is clear. They're wearing the right jersey, a red jersey or a blue jersey, and then you just, everything goes from there. So it's not about their values, but it's about their political team.
When you say they, whom do you mean?
That? Mostly Americans. I'm talking about not all, but left-leaning Americans who I have seen messages all over Twitter where people say things like, well, yeah, but, you know, when they're talking about Iranians, yeah, but there's no but. There's no but. It has nothing to do with Trump. Trump only got involved in this because Americans were involved in this. Trump also didn't care when the Iranians were being killed on the streets either. you know, he is the president of the United States. He's going to get involved when the United States is involved. But that's not relevant. If you are a liberal person and you believe in liberal values, then who the president is or when he gets involved or what he's doing or whatever is completely irrelevant. All you need to be looking at are, who are these people and what are they fighting for? Are they fighting for freedom? Are they fighting for liberal values? If so, then I support them and I stand with them. And that's end of discussion.
So look, I'm thinking that every ideology, when it's exaggerated, it goes into a shadow. So when you exaggerate conservatism, it goes into stagnation. If you exaggerate socialism, it goes into really stupid groupthink. And I believe that if you exaggerate liberalism, it goes into apathy. I mean, it's just this passive allowing things to happen. Mm-hmm. And maybe that shadow is showing itself in that we don't take a stance, that we don't stand up for the liberal values.
That is just too on the nose. That's really depressing, because I really see what you're saying. Because back in my day, like when the, you know, let's talk about like when the Berlin Wall fell or something like that, we weren't apathetic. Hippies were not apathetic. Right. Like liberals really cared in those days, and they were full of energy for liberal values. But I can definitely see the apathy now.
I mean, liberals are still acting upon their principles. I mean, we go after different kind of oppressors. We stand up for LGBTQ rights in some areas. We stand up for women's rights
in some areas.
But there's, I think there's, it's this filter of, and it's, I think it's narrowed down to Islam. I think we went through this whole, you know, reason for it to be, people are afraid and there's a lot of fear, but I want to get back to the ideology of Islam. I mean, you had a lot of your own experience. You also had your academic pursuit of the ideology. And I was meaning to ask you, do you believe that the idea itself, like the ideology itself, is the reason? Is the reason for what's happening, or it's the interpretation of it? Is it Islam itself as an idea, or the people being the problem, like the radical people?
Well, the thing is, these radical people become radicalized because of the ideology. So if you take, for example, you know, my ex, he became a jihadi because his religion taught him that was the best kind of person to be. You know, he wasn't just born and raised a sociopath wanting to go around and murder people. He was a person who wanted to please his God, you know, and if his religion is telling him that the best people are the ones that lose their lives in the name of Allah, then he wants to be among those best people.
I mean, that if all Muslims were to follow that idea, I mean, how come then not all Muslims are martyrs or suicide bombers or
because
jihadists?
Not all anything of any ideology follow their religion exactly, literally.
Yeah,
that never happens.
Right.
First of all, only 15% of Muslims even speak Arabic. Yeah. Can even read it, even understand what the Quran even says. Most of them are just learning from whatever their imam tells them. And if they happen to have the kind of imam that wants to preach that Islam is peace and love, then they are going to learn that Islam is peace and love. They're not learning from the actual religion itself. Very few people do. People like my mom, who went to Al-Azhar University in Egypt, she definitely learned about the religion from the source. But unless you are a scholar, or unless you are, you go through the effort of learning about the religion on your own and circumventing any imams or teachers or translators and just going and doing your own research, most people aren't going to get to the actual truth. I mean, it's just like your average Christian. Your average Christian, same thing. They go to church, you know, once a year or on Christmas or whatever, you know, maybe they wear a gold cross, but it doesn't mean that they've actually studied the Bible. Very few people have. And it's the same thing with Islam. Most Muslims have no idea what's written in their religion. And, you know, when you end up taking a course like the one that I took, it ends up opening your mind, or sorry, opening your eyes to all of these aspects of the religion that you didn't know about, things that were hidden from you because they're ridiculous. Things like in the Quran, where it says the earth is laid in front of you flat like a carpet, you know? If people read that and knew that it said that in the Quran, they would question it. They would think about it. So imams don't mention that, right? They're not saying that in the Friday khutbah. They're not talking about, I mean, sometimes they do. You can see on Kuwaiti television or Saudi Arabian television or whatever, they talk, they make fun of the Westerners for thinking that the earth is a sphere, because obviously Allah said it was flat and he's the one that built the earth, so he knows how he built it, you know. But generally, especially in the West, these kinds of verses are hidden from us. So
I mean these are all, sorry.
I was going to say, when you have 1.6 billion people and you're teaching them all from this same book, not all of them are going to learn exactly everything that's written in that book, but a very frightening percentage of the people will pick up, like, you know, if you look at how the kids in Palestine, what they're being taught, or kids in madrasas in Pakistan, what they're being taught, or in Afghanistan, what they're being taught, those kids, you know, as opposed to the imams that are teaching Islam about peace and love, those imams are teaching specifically the violent verses and specifically about jihad. And of course, not every single one of those children is going to grow up to be a murderer, but some of them will. That's just normal human nature.
I mean, these are all, I mean, both the Quran and the Bible are old texts. I mean, these reflect the culture way, way back then. And reading these texts, either one of them, literally is anti-progress. And as you say, it's a very vulnerable system because it all depends on which community leader or which religious leader who is available. And one could pick paragraphs that promote peace and love, and one can pick paragraphs that promote violence and war. So that's a problem. I'm trying to find not a middle way, but I'm trying to find an understanding and a way forward.
I think the way forward are the group of Muslims that are trying to reform other Muslims, that are trying to get them to cherry pick their religion and ignore all of the racist, anti-Semitic, violent, all of those verses, remove them, ignore them, anything that does not coincide with our progress as humanity to date. So obviously all of the sexist verses, you know, all of those things, just ignore them and just take the bits that match with your liberal or humanist ideals. So take the parts of Islam that match your values.
So have you heard about Shireen Khankan,
No.
Danish female imam?
Oh, I have heard about some female Danish female imam, but I didn't know that was her name.
Oh yeah, yeah. I met her a few years back, and I had a conversation with her in our Swedish podcast. She calls herself an imama. She does a lot of great work, and she started to even wed Muslims and Christians and gay people as well. And there was a lot of course, critique and repercussions. And I even think her husband left her because of that. She was left alone with four kids, but she's doing great work. So there are people within the Muslim community trying to integrate Islam with modern society and doing a lot of great work and putting themselves to risk and danger as well.
Absolutely, and I think that a lot of that work is happening in the West, and that's fantastic to see. But of course, the West only has a very small percentage of Muslims. If we want to see that kind of work happen in the Muslim majority countries, then the first step needs to be to remove the separation of church of mosque and state. So to remove Sharia from the law, from like we need to remove Islam from the laws of the land, because as you said, if you are following a 1400-year-old book to create your laws, then that's definitely anti-progress. A society can't progress if it's following 1400-year-old rule book, you know?
For sure. Mm.
So once we are able to remove forcing people to follow Islam, then I think that you'll see that kind of progress everywhere.
And how do we do that without imposing our value system on those countries and on people? I mean, I believe in standing up for democracy and liberalism, but there's something with the action of you know, almost crusading those values.
Not at all. Like, I mean,
so how do we do that?
I don't think that that's anybody's place to come in there and offer their own values to replace what's going on there. I think that what I would support and what I see happening is freedom and democracy and allowing people to create their own, whatever it is, secular governments based on their own needs and their own wants, and supporting them in that endeavor, for them to choose the government that they feel best would, you know, represent them or support them or protect them.
Right. So there's a difference between imposing those values and empowering the people to be able to choose their own freedom, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Right. And there's this. So a friend of mine who's an ex-cop in Sweden. His name is Mustafa Panshi. Mm-hmm.
I saw him on a Tim Pool video many years ago.
Right. That's him. He's an Afghan who was brought up in Sweden and he worked as a cop for several years, and then during the refugee crisis he started to go out and do public speaking, especially for loncomers from Afghanistan, these groups of young men without any big brothers, any male like role models. He just went out on a tour and did these workshops telling them about Swedish culture and the do's and don'ts and the cultural codes. And we've been talking a lot about the soft bigotry of low expectations, me and Mustafa. And so he's actually doing a lot of good work. He's out there and talking to these mostly guys on equality, on gender equality, on how to treat women, and how to behave in Swedish society to be accepted, and how to integrate. And he's been called racist while doing this from the left and from people who consider him to because they think that we are imposing our value system.
Right.
These kids.
So now this is a different question. So when you have decided to join Sweden. You are coming to this country and you want to be a part of this country, then it is perfectly valid for people of that country to say, well, this is our value system. So I'm not, you know, so now it makes sense because I am welcoming you into my home and I'm telling you, these are the rules. This is how we live here. That I fully support, but I would never go into Iraq or into Iran or into Hong Kong and say, this is the value system that you should take to replace the one that you hate. So I think that there's a very big difference between those two questions.
For sure. So one is actually standing up for liberal values and the other one is crusading. So I would go back to the first one as we were talking about the shadow of liberalism. So that's actually showing its face in Sweden right now. Like we don't, it's almost like we are ashamed of standing up for what we believe in. Mm-hmm. It might be some kind of conflict avoidance. It might be fear. It might also be that we haven't had a reason to do that before. But it's very interesting to see what happens when we need to do that. Like Mustafa has this analogy. He says that we invited the whole world to play soccer. Mm-hmm. So
these are the rules.
These are but we don't tell people what the rules are. We expect them to know what the rules are, and when they don't, we get mad at them. Mm-hmm. And
I said that's a perfect analogy.
It is. I mean, how are you supposed to know how to act, how to behave in a new country if no one tells you, like, this is okay to do, this is not okay to do? Mm-hmm. And if you don't stand up for those values, if you don't stand up for liberalism, well, people who have more confidence in their ideology will take over.
Thank you. 100% exactly. That is exactly why I get terrified when I see people in the West unwilling to stand up for Western values unapologetically. And the reason why it scares me is because I think things like LGBT equality and feminism and things like that are so fragile. They're so new. And we absolutely have to defend them because the other side are very, very loud and strong and committed in defending their values. And so if we are not going to defend ours, then we're definitely going to lose.
For sure. But I don't think we've gotten that far yet. I think we're only in the beginning.
No, I don't think we've gotten that far either, but I think it's very important, like you said, because we haven't needed to before. So I think that it's important now to express support and pride and happiness in the progress that we have achieved instead of constantly self-flagellating. I mean, I assume that Sweden is doing much of the same things that's happening here in North America, where it's just a constant criticism of our society, but we never do the other side, where we never celebrate what we have achieved. And that ends up becoming incredibly sad when you look at, like, for example, young women. We're always telling young women, you're living in a patriarchal society. You know, you have to fight for what you get and men are out to get you and da 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 da. So we're constantly putting them in this mindset of being the victim. And I think that is, first of all, it's just untrue. And second of all, it's so disempowering. I grew up with second wave feminism where it was the exact opposite, where it was just this constant empowerment of women can do whatever we want. Nobody can stand in our way. Right. We are the ones who get to decide how we're going to live our lives. If we want to stay at home and be moms, that's our decision. If we want to go to work and not have children, that's our decision. It just was a completely different narrative, like a completely different messaging that young women were getting.
Yeah.
And I'm a college professor, so I see young women these days, and I can see how that messaging is affecting them. And I feel like shaking them and saying, it's a lie. It's all a lie. It's not true. You don't live in Iran. You know what I mean? Like, and even Iranian women, actually, you know, to be perfectly honest, they're the strongest women on the planet.
I mean, they're far from victims.
They're far from victims. That was a bad example. But I mean, their society tries to make them victims, but they are exactly the kind of women that the rest of women across the planet should be looking to as examples and saying, despite all of the suppressions around these women, look at them. They're phenomenal. And we are spoiled in comparison, where we have nothing but opportunities. And what do? We complain. And it's almost shameful that we have that perspective or that impression of ourselves when you look at how other women are surviving and how other women are living and how what other women are achieving. And then you just start to feel, I think, just really grateful. That's what I want women to feel in the West. I want them to feel grateful, and I want them to feel empowered. And I want them to know about the feminists that have come before them and that have made all of this possible, instead of them complaining that life is no different than it was 100 years ago. Well, when you do that, you are insulting the memory of all of these women that have fought for you to have this equality that you're now pretending you don't have.
I think that applies to not only women, but I think that applies to people in especially in Sweden or in the Scandinavian countries who have reached that level of liberalism or liberal democracy. I think that would be another shadow, if I may, of individualism, which is entitlement. Mm-hmm. So the shadow of individualism would be entitlement, because we've been taught to explore the self, to develop ourselves, to focus on ourselves. And when you do that too much, I'm sorry, excuse my language, but you become an asshole.
Narcissism.
A narcissistic asshole. And I think that it would be nice for us to consider that maybe individualism or even liberalism are not sufficient. Maybe we could mix it up. I mean, I believe in dynamic resolutions. Like, maybe there are parts of conservatism we could use. Maybe there are parts of socialism we can use as well. And maybe we can use different parts of these systems and ideologies to build something more dynamic. Because I think that every ideology, if we follow one ideology, it becomes its own tyrant.
Oh yeah, then it's no different than being a fundamentalist of any religion too, right? It's
for sure.
A political tribe. But yeah, I 100% agree with you.
So maybe I'm thinking that maybe the answer to how to look at this, I don't want to say war or battle, but I want to see this issue or this challenge of getting all these people from different religions and ideologies to live together. Maybe liberalism won't solve that by its own. Maybe we need something sharper, more potent. I don't know, but maybe liberalism in itself is too soft, or maybe we're treating it too soft.
I think that's the case. I think that that liberalism could be more successful if we actually stood by our liberal values. Like if we actually had, we need to have stop signs. That's the problem. Like people, there's a misunderstanding. Yes, liberalism means that you're allowed to practice whatever you want to practice and believe whatever you want to believe. But there are boundaries, there are stop signs, there are limits. And I think that's where we fail, is we fail to be very clear on where our limits are.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I see that. I see that in Sweden. I see that manifesting in Sweden all the time. Like we're very prone on rights, but not on obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Like we have all these liberties, but we don't talk as much about what we expect from each other,
right?
Or what is not to be compromised.
Yes, yeah, that's right. There's
like
always
boundaries.
They should always come in tandem. Rights and responsibilities should always be in the same sentence.
And that's I think that's what Mustafa is doing. Actually, he's actually telling these guys what's okay and what is not okay to do. Because there are do's and don'ts.
Mm-hmm.
There are real do's and don'ts, but I think Swedes have the tendency to not telling you what the don'ts are. Mm. But if you step over those boundaries, there will be repercussions.
And that's not fair, is it? Like,
no.
How are they're setting people up for failure?
Yeah,
and they're not helping people by doing that.
I'm also curious, as a college professor, what tendencies do you see on campus? And I've been following the conversation in the US a lot about safe spaces and trigger warnings, and I've seen some of the tendencies in Sweden. We're a few years after you guys, but I'm a bit concerned, I must tell you, because as you were saying, I don't think we should protect each other from friction or from difficult conversations or from conflicts even. I think I believe in brave spaces. I believe in growing up, in maturing through friction, through hardship. But that doesn't seem to be the case on several college campuses in the States. How about yours?
Yeah, no, I think that in the States it's a much bigger problem. So I saw a Harvard professor who was talking about, so she actually is a lawyer, so she was teaching future lawyers, and she had to stop talking about laws surrounding rape because it was too much of a triggering for people in the classroom. And I thought, well, that's pretty detrimental. Like I can see some real problems if you've got future lawyers, you know, that don't know enough about rape laws. So it's her responsibility, I think, to push the students, find a way to still get them to learn the information. While I think in her particular situation, like in places like Harvard, Ivy League universities, it's more difficult for the professors to push the envelope. But generally, I think that's really professor specific. Like it's there's usually a culture within the university, but you do what you want within your own classroom. So you'll have, like, you know, for me, I always tell my students that if you're not uncomfortable, if you're not being challenged, then you're not learning. You know, learning happens outside of your comfort zone. So you have to be not only, you have to embrace that. You have to look forward to that. And you have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable, because that's the only way that you're going to learn. I mean, that was definitely my experience when I was leaving Islam. It was very uncomfortable, you know, but you don't learn, You don't learn anything if you just stay in your own comfortable little safe space. But, you know, in Canada, we have our issues too. We have some, you know, there was a woman who lost her job as a TA because she was talking about Jordan Peterson, who is a famous professor here at the University of Toronto. You know him. Okay. Yeah. And we have other professors that say, if you cite Jordan Peterson on any of your papers, then it's an automatic fail.
Yeah.
So we have that kind of difficulties, you know, like they, I don't know, some people are saying that guy was joking. I don't know if he was joking or not. The point is, we do have difficulties like that in our universities in Canada as well. We have people that want to speak and they get deplatformed, they get shouted down. But on the whole, I think that it's important to keep on pushing, to keep on going. And to be perfectly honest, there are always, I want to say the majority of students, but I can't say that definitely, but there are always students who want to fight against the status quo, but they don't feel confident enough to do so. Because what is acceptable is the dominant narrative of just like far left PC culture. That's what you hear all the time, and that is what is accepted to talk about. And so they end up going underground and like going online and having a Twitter handle or watching YouTube channels or whatever to try and satiate that curiosity in them that isn't happening in the classrooms. Now, I've, you know, students have told me that they've had profs that when they try to bring up a different perspective, the prof will shut down the conversation and be like, okay, you know, there's no need to get into that, or, you know, different people have different opinions, and they just don't want to, they don't want to offer counter narratives. They don't want to offer counter perspectives. And a lot of times those profs are worried about themselves too.
Yeah, exactly. Because they get fired. There are like people signing petitions to get them fired. It's a really hard time to be a college professor right now, but also there's an opportunity to, again, stand up for something, to really, really show up for those liberal principles. I mean, as the University of Chicago are doing with the Chicago principles, it's an anti-reaction to the whole trigger warning safe spaces conversation. Mm-hmm. So they're actually putting forward a set of principles telling the students, if you want to come here, these are the rules. Mm-hmm. You are going to be triggered. Mm-hmm. You are going to be uncomfortable, and we are going to support you to be able to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
It's declared. Exactly. It's very clear. Mm-hmm. And I think that will escalate even more in the following years. I think, again, this is only the beginning, and I'm both a little bit terrified and curious to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear to me that there are not only one reaction, but there's also an anti-reaction to the whole safe spaces.
Yeah, and then, I mean, to be perfectly honest, what I'm seeing more than anything with this generation of students is entitlement for sure, but also apathy. They have the attention span of a gnat. I mean, it's not like it used to be when I was in university, where we would have like one question and we would spend the whole hour delving into it and discussing it, and different people have different ideas and different perspectives. Now students just want the answer and they want to move on. They want to swipe and click, and they want it quickly. And that is the thing that worries me the most, is just the reduction of our, we're shallow now. Everybody is just on the surface, and we're losing that deep dive thinking that used to be common on university campuses.
I don't totally agree with you, but I think that the movement is still there, but it may not be as present on college campuses. But I mean, the whole you know, network of podcasts and YouTubers and forums online is massive.
No,
maybe absolutely. The conversation just moved somewhere else. Where
it, no, exactly. That's why I said that those students that crave that have to go on Twitter and YouTube to satiate that need in them, because it's not being met on the campuses anymore.
Right. Maybe it's just a change of,
you know, I think that's what university used to, that was its whole purpose. Right.
Yeah. But it could also be like a part of the evolution of universities, like these old institutions. Maybe they've done their part. Maybe they're just about to become soil for the new thing to grow up from. I don't know. I'm really curious to see what happens. But what I do know is that, as you were saying about the shallowness and also the lack of attention, I think especially the issue of Islam and Islam versus modern secular society, that's a complex issue. Mm-hmm. It takes time. You need to have a capacity to digest complex complex issues, and that takes time. It takes focus, and it's not done in a haste. That's why there are no shortcuts, and it's probably going to be an issue for decades to come. Maybe the universities are not the place to solve this issue at all. Maybe it's done in a new manner that we don't know of yet. So 2020, is it the first time you're doing no hijab?
No, this is third year.
Third year. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that. What's hijab day?
So hijab day is February 1st, and it's practiced, or it is observed, in 140 countries across the world. And on that day, what they do is they set up booths, different universities, different political, government buildings, and they have hijabs, and they give them out to non-Muslim women, and they encourage them to wear hijab for a day. So it is, encouraging people to wear hijab. So the counter to that would have been, of course, to encourage people not to wear hijab, but I can't do that because I know that people can get in a lot of trouble for that. Even here in Canada, a young 16-year-old girl was killed for not wearing hijab. So I would never ask somebody to not wear hijab. But what we do instead is we support women who have made the decision to remove their hijabs, but they have had to overcome difficulties, whether it was from their families, from their societies, from their communities, whatever it is. So it's a day for us to celebrate those women, encourage them to share their stories with us, and just for us to applaud them. And they have had to deal with a lot of backlash and negativity. So this is just a day where we get to share positivity. And that's what it is. So the hashtag is No Hijab Day, as well as hashtag Free From Hijab.
Thanks for clearing that out. I know you have an appointment soon. I'm just wanted to invite you to tell our listeners, how can they find you? It's Twitter, right?
So I have a website, yasminmuhammad.com. I'm also pretty active on Twitter. And I also run an organization called Free Hearts, Free Minds. So I hope that your listeners will look that up. So that's just www.freeheartsfreeminds.com. And that organization helps free thinkers who are living in the Muslim majority world. So they're living in circumstances where they cannot share their apostasy publicly, and that causes all sorts of trauma. And so if you go to my website, if you go to the website for freehearts.freeminds.com, you can click on testimonials and read about how we have helped people through our organization. And hopefully you will be encouraged to donate.
And also your book is out, Unveiled. Mm-hmm. Can you find it as an audiobook as well?
Yeah, here it is, Unveiled. And yes, it's available on Kindle. The audiobook is not out quite yet, but it will be out soon, inshallah.
I really appreciate your work, Yasmin. Thank you so much for being on the How Can We podcast. I hope to talk more to you soon. Finally, just as we ask all of our guests, who would you like to see on the podcast, or who would you like us to invite as a guest on the podcast?
I think that a person who I would love to see in your podcast is Masi Ahmadinejad, who is an Iranian woman who fights for not just women in Iran, but anybody in Iran who is fighting for their freedom against the Islamic regime. She has a book out called Wind in My Hair, and it tells all of her life story and all of the advocacy that she's done as a journalist and an activist. So all of her work for Iranian people.
Can you say her name again?
I cannot. So her first name is Masi and her last name is Alinejad. It's Alinejad. And her first name is Masi, Masih.
Oh, yeah. Found it.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. A phenomenal woman. And I think she's who I would recommend.
So, Yasmin, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I wish you all luck and hope you keep on doing your valuable work.
Thank you so much.
Keep the conversation going. Yeah. So I hope I talk to you soon, and preferably we can sit in the same room next time.
I hope so.
I'll definitely come to Canada to visit you guys.
Awesome.
Okay.
I'm coming to Sweden. So.
Oh, you're very welcome. I will love that.
Great. All right. Thank you again for having me.
Thanks.